Thanks, Jeff, for that introduction, and thank you all for the opportunity to talk with you all this afternoon. I'm not going to use slides, and I'm going to try my best to not speak for too long. You know, I come from four generations of fast-talking Texans, so I can go on indefinitely, but this is a group that knows a lot about the issues that I was asked to talk about reimbursement, about regulatory changes, about this kind of transition, as Jeff said, between the two panels that you're hearing this afternoon. And I want to leave some time for questions and comments from you all. And I want to encourage you, if you have any questions or comments along the way for my remarks, to please interrupt. I do want to start with the subject of the next panel. One of the things that's a big challenge in policy is that they often don't match up with where biomedical innovation and technology and knowledge tell us we should be, and where the innovation is telling us we should be in the years ahead, hopefully the not too distant future, is in a much more personalized approach to cancer therapy. There's been a tremendous amount of progress over the past decade in understanding that cancer isn't a disease, but a collection of modifications in genetic pathways, in metabolomics, in other features of particular cancer subtypes that matter for the right combinations of treatments for particular patients. I remember when I was FDA commissioner and would say that, you know, for all the promise of genomics, I can count on one hand the number of drugs that have been approved with a label that said anything about genomics in it. That's really changed, particularly in cancer care. And if you look at where care is headed, it's going to be even more different in the future, hopefully sooner rather than later. Unfortunately, neither are financing policies or our regulatory policies are well suited for that transition to more personalized therapy. And what I want to talk about in my few minutes here is a couple of directions hitting on both reimbursement and regulatory changes where there is some promise for addressing that gap. And it's a gap that I think we need to address. You know, we are finding better approaches to cancer therapy, but how quickly that happens and how effectively it actually reaches patients is going to depend a lot on what we do collectively, including all of you who are working in the industry and clinicians and people in academics to help us get there. On the reimbursement side, as you heard in the last panel, there are some steps now taking place to move away from sort of a volume and intensity-based approach to reimbursement in this country and a global basis for reimbursement in other countries that are focused much more on getting, potentially more on getting better results for individual patients. The approaches that are taken here because of some real gaps in both quality of care and opportunities for improving care. If cancer treatment is becoming more personalized, where a particular combination of drug therapies based on a particular combination of diagnostic tests for a patient is the right set of therapies, that's sort of the opposite direction from where broad-based price regulation of drug prices and of diagnostic prices should be taking you. What we're aiming for is treatments that are highly valuable in individual patients, or combinations of treatments that are highly valuable in individual treatments, and where we have the diagnostic information to know that. And that's just not well suited to approaches to trying to control healthcare costs by squeezing down prices and regulating to the same price for particular treatments for very different patients. The kinds of reforms that you heard about in the last panel, I think are going to be increasingly important, not just for the reasons that you heard about in the last panel, but because of these reasons of personalization, it gives reimbursement a chance to do a better job of following the value for individual patients. But it does mean more accountability and responsibility on providers, on product developers in these systems for tracking and improving on something other than the volume and intensity of chemotherapy agents and other treatments that they are using. I also think the time has come for some of these reforms because of the frustrations that Deborah and others have described on the last panel and elsewhere, that for practicing in oncology today, because of these price squeezes and the increasing difficulty of cross-subsidizing things like reimbursement for actually spending time with a patient and their family to develop and apply a plan of care and making sure it's up to date, dealing with complications that the patient has, hopefully before they come into your office, let alone the emergency room, making sure that they are receiving the latest evidence-based treatments for their condition, all those things are very poorly reimbursed under traditional reimbursement systems and contribute to getting in the way of value for individual patients. There's kind of alignment between increasing frustration with current payment systems in practice and the need for where reimbursement ought to go to support better, more personalized care. Some of the reforms that are taking place in this direction, I don't think are going to move all the way in the direction of bundled payment or capitation. And I would encourage you not to think about this as an either-or proposition. And so to introduce that idea, let me back up for a second and talk about accountable care organizations and some of the reforms in payment that really are intending to move in this direction as they focus on value, performance, better results for individual patients rather than volume and intensity. The way I think about these and the way that we implemented some of the forerunners of accountable care organizations at CMS in the physician group practice demonstration program was that we needed to set up a second track of reimbursement to start addressing the gaps that the absence of payments for some valuable services for individual payments created, but we couldn't do it in a way that just meant more fee-for-service payments because of concerns about rising costs. We needed to do it in a way that included some accountability. So in these early ACOs and in the ACOs that are part of the new Medicare program and that many private insurers are implementing today, the way to think about it, I believe, is that as setting up a second track of payment. So typically these organizations aren't wholesale abandoning their fee-for-service traditional reimbursement systems, but rather they're setting up a second track where, in addition to tracking the volume and intensity of services they're providing that they get reimbursed for under traditional reimbursement systems, they are also starting to track measures of performance that really matter and that are feasible to track. So in a typical ACO today, or in the new Medicare ACOs, the organizations are tracking things like the use of screening treatments for patients, for their population of patients who are potentially at risk for breast cancer or colorectal cancer. So they're, you know, evidence-based screening guidelines. How widely are those guidelines actually being applied? For other common diseases like diabetes and heart failure and coronary artery disease that make up a good half of costs in the Medicare program, they're starting to track things like the extent to which the diseases are controlled, so hemoglobin A1C levels, blood pressure levels, lipid profiles, and things like that, as well as complications, rates of emergency room visits, rates of hospitalizations, as well as measures of patient experience. And along with tracking these measures of performance, the Medicare program or the other payers who are involved in the ACOs are also tracking the overall cost of care for the patients. And the deal is that in addition to whatever payments you may receive on the in your traditional track, you can get a shared savings payment based on showing that you're improving in most of these dimensions of performance and improving in terms of an overall reduction in cost trends. That's the idea of shared savings. And then what a number of these ACOs are doing as they get more experience with these kinds of payment systems is moving more of the weight in their reimbursement from that first track based on the traditional volume and intensity approach to the second track based on better results at a lower cost. What that means is that things that traditionally would cause you to lose money, things like spending time with a patient, avoiding that emergency room visit, not using that more expensive but not evidence-based chemotherapy and so forth, now have a mechanism for helping you sustain your practice, helping you make ends meet. So everybody with me so far? Okay. Am I boring people? I hope not. And over time, as the organizations get more familiar with get the data systems in place for tracking their patients over time, you know, some of these ACOs, when they're starting, they don't even have a way of determining who their patients are, let alone whether they're getting evidence-based care for prevention or for these common chronic diseases. But over time, they start getting better data systems in place. They reorganize care in ways that now is financially sustainable because they're not getting paid on traditional volume and intensity. Over time, they can make more improvements and make further incremental changes in the way that they're paid. This kind of approach has not yet come in a widespread way to oncology care. There are some exceptions. You heard about the United States United example just a minute ago, and from what Brian was saying, I think he introduced that by saying, well, you know, we're not doing this because there's any overuse involved, but then he went on to say that, you know, that what this system does is effectively decouple the way that the oncology practices are getting reimbursed for care for patients from the volume and intensity of chemotherapy that they're administering, which is the primary source of, or a primary source of revenues, and for Medicare patients as well. And I think that's going to be the pathway, maybe not moving fully to a capitated bundle, but what some practices are doing is identifying some ways in which the money that currently is flowing, the revenues that currently are flowing through chemo administration and the ASP plus six margins and things like that, could be used for other aspects of care management, care coordination for particular patients, you know, maybe a case management fee or something like that, that would allow the practices to spend more time doing what they think is important for the patient and not be tied so much to revenues from the chemotherapy in order to make ends meet for their practice. And that notion, I think, is very consistent with the idea I was talking about before about more personalized care. If it's not the, you know, if the way to get better results for patients at a lower cost is to support their individualized needs, then it would be nice if something in our reimbursement system was tied to better results for that patient rather than just the volume and intensity of treatments provided. So I think the challenge in implementing these kinds of reforms is coming up with the feasible measures that can be used for an alternative to volume and intensity in these payment systems. For diabetes, we have some good markers of outcomes like hemoglobin A1C levels. For some cancers, it's a bit more challenging. Some of the pilot programs that I've seen around the country are using approaches like rates of emergency room visits with preventable complications, some measures of patient experience, whether an evidence-based and NCCN guideline is are being followed, things like that. But this is still very much in the development process. And again, this isn't something that has to be implemented wholesale with a sudden move from, you know, traditional reimbursement system all the way over to a global budget or a complete capitated payment or a bundled payment or something like that. They're intermediate steps along the way, and I think we will be seeing more examples of that in the next few years. I did want to change gears a little bit and talk briefly about innovation opportunities on the pre-market side, on the regulatory side too, as I think you'll hear about more in the next panel and probably have heard about in other parts of this conference as well. This is a big year for regulatory reform. So the FDA user fees are up for reauthorization this year, and every 5 years when that happens, it's an opportunity for other types of legislation to move along with the user fee reauthorizations. And one of the big themes in the legislative process that's going on now is finding ways to make more personalized, individualized therapies more sustainable and getting to market faster and finding out which treatments are really safe and effective, or in the case of cancer treatments where there are no good alternatives, at least effective, more quickly and efficiently. FDA has a number of existing mechanisms to try to speed the availability of innovative treatments. They have a fast-track regulatory process for treatments that address unmet medical needs to have more support, more interaction with FDA. There's a priority review process for shortening the review cycle after, you know, all the pre-market tests are largely completed and the applications coming in. And there's an accelerated approval program, which allows for approvals based on surrogate endpoints with a requirement for confirmatory studies after treatments are approved. Particularly in the area of cancer care, there are some ideas being considered in the legislative process now that would try to adapt these kinds of programs more to ideas related to combination treatments and more targeted therapies. Last fall, we had a conference, one that we co-sponsor every year at Brookings with the Friends of Cancer Research, where some of these ideas related to targeted approval were discussed. And I think these fit with the notion that FDA and many product developers are starting to pursue now for more targeted, adaptive trial design. So what will hopefully come out of this legislative process are some support for reforms in the FDA that would enable the development process to focus in a more targeted way on particular subgroups of patients where a combination of genomic markers, metabolomic markers indicates a high probability of response, enabling a more targeted trial for that subgroup of patients, and when there is evidence of significant clinical response, a faster pathway to approval may be linked to more extensive post-market surveillance, more of a continuous life cycle of a combination of drugs where additional evidence could be gathered on other patient subgroups maybe after approval. Approaches like that are very much in consideration right now and are reflected in some of the recent trials that have been completed, and I hope that's something that you all will get into on the next panel as well. So I just want to close by emphasizing that this is a truly critical time for getting to more personalized care for cancer patients. The technological opportunities are there. They're not yet fulfilled yet. The financing reform opportunities are there. They're not yet fulfilled. The opportunities for regulatory reform that are more focused on targeted therapy approval and developing more evidence on additional subgroups of patients in the post-market setting, those opportunities are there, but not yet fulfilled. And I hope as we keep coming back to meetings like this one over the next few years, we'll be able to see a lot more progress in achieving this goal of more targeted cancer therapy. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to join you. I'd be happy to thank you. Thank you. Would very much enjoy any questions or comments that you all might have. I think we have a few minutes, right? Yeah, I doubt that. This is a very knowledgeable group, though.
Thank you. The coverage with evidence development that really was developed under your leadership, I just wonder if that activity is still going on, whether there's any possibility for further extension of it. Certainly, it did look as though one of the smart ways to collect large blocks of data, which has been a subject of this meeting for a lot of this.
Coverage of evidence development at CMS is still very much part of their coverage process. So it's generally been done in conjunction with national coverage decisions. And I think one of the recent statistics that I saw was that in the past decade, something like 1 in 5 of NCDs have had some CED component along with it. Now, the vast majority of those, almost all of them actually, have been device approval. So, most recently, the transcatheter aortic valve replacement system that Edwards developed has been subject to this with a post-market registry and the like. Unfortunately, the program still is there. Unfortunately, I think its applications for oncology drugs have not been as effective as I had hoped. And CMS recently sought comments on where the program stands, where it should be going, and this was a major theme. It was a major theme in comments that we submitted kind of on behalf of a group of organizations, a major theme in, I think, some other organization comments as well. The challenge is, and this would be maybe a good way to illustrate this, was with the CED for some cancer for some oncology biologics that went into effect when I was at CMS, where we said we would cover, CMS said that we would cover for off-label, off-compendium indications for some of these drugs. The challenge was when you have an opportunity to do a CED, it's in the context of a national coverage decision, which is a specific request that comes into CMS or one that, CMS could put forward and say, as we did then, that for these kinds of cancers, we would be willing to support coverage of the drug in the context of trials. The trials that were available at the time were ones that I think were quite valid and understandable, but they were reflecting kind of NIH priorities on drug development, which aren't necessarily, at least then, weren't necessarily tied to some of the most important practical questions about, you know, for Medicare beneficiaries who might have other comorbidities and might have already tried six other drugs for their indication, they were really relevant to their to those populations. And CMS has never had the financing authority to set up an infrastructure for, you know, sustaining the data collection and the trials that would be relevant to those topics. And so I think a very important question for CED effectiveness going forward is there some way to pair CMS coverage with an infrastructure that does a better job of identifying and providing a mechanism for storing the data, collecting the data, storing the data, supporting the analyses that CMS can't support directly. In some areas of device coverage, that's happened. The American College of Cardiology, some of the other cardiac specialty societies working with product developers and in some cases with the NHLBI have set up some ongoing registries that have been now adapted to a number of different ICDs, pacemakers, and the like. But I don't think we have anything like that for oncology. I think it sure would be helpful for a next generation of CED.
Thanks for the talk, Mark.
Anyways, you know, it's a forward-looking talk for a lot of issues that you've raised and suggestions. In my view, and I've always felt a little frustrated by this, because I was actually a computer scientist a long time ago, then went into, you know, MD-PhD and then industry. What we need is a universal EMR. That's just the reality.
Yeah.
That would help a lot of these problems. It would be an incredible tool.
And
it would be much more efficient, better quality healthcare, and it would allow, you know, faster approval for things and the post-marketing follow-up, everything like, you know, are we ever going to wake up to this reality and be able to accept it and build it?
Yeah, I think we're getting there towards better interoperable data, but I don't think we're going to wake up one morning and boom, it'll be in place. You know, one of the challenges that we've seen is in a lot of these organizations that are becoming ACOs or they're trying to, you know, deliver more coordinated efficient care and get paid for it, you know, be accountable for that rather than just volume and intensity, is that the off-the-shelf electronic records don't, you know, automatically solve all their problems. You know, even if they've spent all, you know, the time and effort of adopting such a system within their own offices, if they're on Epic and the other guys are on, Siemens systems or something else, even though they're working off the same standards, in practice, the data don't flow all that easily. Moreover, the practical reality today is, even with more dissemination of health IT, lots of places are not yet fully on with electronic records. So what I've actually found to be more practically helpful, and again, this will eventually get to your goal, is starting with something less than a full EHR. So many of those ACOs that we worked with, you know, over the last 5 years started with basically just maybe a web-based registry for their patients. So, you know, who are our patients with diabetes? And one source of information for that would be a claims feed, a timely claims feed from some of their private insurers. And another source might be, you know, each office typing in, if they don't have an electronic record in place, at least a list of who their patients were. And then you can start asking some good basic questions. You know, are these patients getting regular follow-up? And often the answer is no. Sometimes the insurers would identify patients who are getting care for diabetes or seem to be diabetes-related from multiple places, but nobody was taking kind of primary charge of making sure that, you know, they're getting evidence-based preventive care. So starting with something like a simple registry and then building on that over time has been a much more practical approach. I think you end up getting to the same goal, but the focus isn't on the IT. The focus is on, you know, let's identify some specific ways right now that we can improve care. And we can do it by, you know, here's how much it would cost for us to develop this registry, even though we don't have IT systems in place. Here's what we think we could do based on what we know about our patients in terms of improving care using this registry. How much would that save? How much would it improve outcomes? And is that a worthwhile strategy for the next year? And then, you know, keep doing that over time. And that's what, you know, some of these oncology practice reforms that I mentioned earlier, you know, they don't start with trying to boil the ocean. I mean, let's go to full-scale integrated EHRs, because we don't have it. It'd be expensive to put in and take time and a lot of burden on our providers, and the other providers we work with don't have them anyway. So let's instead try to, for some more modest goals of, you know, tracking all of our patients, identifying those that seem to have more frequent ER visits or being back to see us more frequently, have some kind of intervention focused on, you know, reaching out to them. Maybe our staff oncologists, instead of just doing rounds in the hospital, would set aside some time in evenings and weekends to be available for timely calls or maybe some extra visit or time with these patients. And then let's make that work financially, since it's saving money and improving quality, and then, you know, keep building from there.
Hey, Mark, great talk. You've had some great op-ed pieces in the journal in the last year or so. A pretty pointed question for you. What's going to happen with the Supreme Court and Obamacare?
stay tuned. It should be some really interesting oral arguments and kind of a highlight of American jurisprudence for the last half century. You know, it's I divide that into three main questions. So first question is it time to rule on this case? There's a post-Civil War law that, at least under some interpretations, would seem to say that if it's a question about a constitutionality of a tax, you can't address that in court until someone's actually been assessed the tax and has to pay it, in which case we have to, and some judges have ruled, you know, this case is not ripe until 2014. Everybody on both sides is arguing before the Supreme Court saying, no, that's not right, rule now, and here's why. Plus, if you wait till 2014, it's going to be an enormous cost and uncertainty for the whole country. So that's another reason why you should rule now. Second question is about the mandate. And on both sides, the arguments have been that the individual mandate is tied to the insurance market reforms, another core part of the law, the guaranteed issue and community rating. You know, those do go together. Guaranteed issue and community rating is the most popular provision in the law. Even Republican, you know, rank and file Republicans support it. You know, they want to see healthcare reform where people, you know, who are responsibly paying their premiums can keep getting coverage even if they shift jobs or even if they get a chronic disease like cancer. But it's linked to the least popular provision because of the way the law is set up, at least, and according to the arguments of most actuaries, you can't have guaranteed issue and community rating unless you've got everybody in the insurance market. So that's probably the biggest question where I think the Supreme Court watchers are the most split, although I guess the odds still favor the law being upheld. And the third main area is around Medicaid and the requirements of the states to help pay for and implement these big expansions of the Medicaid programs. I think there's been, you know, some people think that's an overreach, but most of the courts have argued that is constitutional. What I would say is, regardless of how so I'm not answering your question, but regardless of how the Supreme Court rules on these issues, and particularly on the individual mandate, this is not a done deal. Even if the Republicans do end up sweeping, and I guess, you know, some people are saying that the odds of that are longer than they were a couple of months ago, much of the law, not all of it, can be undone by reconciliation, just with, you know, 50 votes in the Senate plus the vice president. But even if the Democrats stay in control of the presidency and both houses, there's going to be a lot of pressure for change. It's going to be a big lift to get this law actually implemented on schedule in 2014. And beyond that, the mandate is getting less, not more popular. And I think one of the relatively easy things for Congress to do with unpopular provisions is maybe not repeal them outright, but put them off a little bit. So the mandate itself is not that big of a penalty to begin with. It's phased in over several years. I could easily see a bipartisan vote for pushing that back another year or two, especially if there's some bumps in the road in getting the coverage off the ground, or if the coverage available in 2014 turns out, at least in some cases, to be more expensive or look expensive to the American public. So all of you who are concerned about cancer in particular need to be paying attention to finding ways to make health care and health insurance reform work without a strong mandate. It's not easy. It can be done. Part D is Medicare Part D is a voluntary program, no mandate, has some features that the insurance exchanges don't. But you know, regardless of who wins, and if the Republicans win and try to repeal, they're going to have to replace it with something else that is not a mandate. So we need to find a way to make that work better.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you all.
Great.